I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Johnson, and today we're joined by sports psychologist, Dr. Greg Carton. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, Andy, thanks for having me. Looking forward to speaking and being a fan of the podcast. Was looking forward to being on it.
Yeah, for sure. So, Greg, I met out at the Players' Championship. Greg works with a handful of guys on the PGA Tour, Web Tour, Latin America and Canadian Tour. Greg, I'd love to hear how you got into kind of sports psychology and golf specifically.
Sure. Yeah, no, it started at a relatively young age. I played soccer and lacrosse through college. Also played competitive golf, but not in school, you know, in the summers and amateur events, and was always fascinated by the difference, mindset between what it was like to compete in a team environment as opposed to, when you're out there all by yourself. So I read a lot of stuff about Bob Rotella and some other sports psychologists at the time, got really interested, went back, after I graduated, undergrad. Took a few years off and then went back to get my master's in sports psych and kept going, got my doctorate and started my own practice. And that's how it sort of began. I worked with a young professional golfer right when I opened my private practice, and he had some success and some, you know, word of mouth, got a few more clients, and now I'm here and I work, I'd say 95% of my clients are now all golfers. And selfishly, I enjoy that too, because I really enjoy the sport. And I think the stuff I believe in really helps when it comes to golf, as opposed to maybe some other sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think every golfer who's ever tried to play in tournament golf, you realize like you're just a head case. You know, in the back, and you
look, yeah, pretty much.
You look around, and you know, I always look around, and I look at like the, you know, players that are a little bit better than me. I'm like, what are they thinking about that I'm not thinking about? Because I'm thinking about just all kinds of bad stuff. But I'm kind of, I'm curious, like, how's your schedule work? Do you spend a lot of time on the road, or are you primarily just, you know, do you have phone calls? How does it work when you're working with players?
Yeah, no, the beauty of technology now is you don't need to meet with people face-to-face necessarily, whether Skype or FaceTime is always good. So I have clients from, you know, all over the country. I do make it obviously a priority, though, to spend as much time as I can with people in person. So I do get out on the road. I'll spend time at events, usually Sunday through Wednesday or Thursday. But I also have quite a few clients, you know, back here at home who, you know, juniors and some high school kids, some college kids, and some, you know, amateur players around the area that I meet with in person in my office as well. So it's a varied sort of group. I have some clients who are beginning, you know, 25 handicappers and all the way to professionals who have won major events. So, and you just mentioned something pretty interesting before this idea. You're always wondering what other people are thinking, like guys that play at the highest level. And I always start my talks with the point that, you know, if you took 30 of the top players in the world and 30 beginners and then 30 maybe decent amateurs, and had them all write one question or one thing they were concerned with on a piece of, on a notebook, on a note card, and handed them in, and you read, you wouldn't know who they were coming from. Everyone in that respect has the same issues as far as what they're thinking about and what they're worried about and their concerns and how they don't get in their own way. So we're all similar when it comes to that, which I thought was always pretty interesting.
So I'm curious, what is the most common, kind of thing that you work with golfers? Like, what's the first thing that usually jumps out when you get a new patient, we'll say, since we're all sick?
I guess the bottom line is a lot of our struggles on the course come from one thing, and that's fear, right? Fear of, what we're going to shoot, or fear of what our parents are going to say to us after, or fear of how I'm going to feel if I blow a big lead, or if I, everyone knows I'm supposed to play well and I don't, what am I going to have to say? So I think when you boil it all down, a lot of our struggles on the course come from the avoidance of fear. That's number one. And number two is, and as a golfer, I'm sure you're familiar with this too, we all, and like you said before, I wonder, people are always wondering, people, can I be more like that guy? Why can't I think more like them or swing like them? Always comparing ourselves to others. So being a little bit unfair to ourselves and a little bit mean to ourselves, as far as how we speak to ourselves, is probably the other major thing that I end up talking with people about, because it's just not part of competitive athletic culture to treat ourselves nicely. We always think that to motivate ourselves, we need to be mean to ourselves or berate ourselves. And we're finding more and more now research shows that if you can support yourself, you're going to operate from a much safer place, and usually results will be better.
It's interesting. I made a New Year's resolution this year that I was never going to tell myself on the golf course that I sucked.
Right, how'd that go?
So it's only happened one time, and I immediately was like, why did I just do that? But amazingly, I've gotten off to some terrible starts in tournaments, and by not telling myself I sucked, I've ended up shooting really good scores for being in positions that I've been. Whereas in years past, I think I would have just kept playing worse and worse.
Yeah, that's a fantastic insight. And sometimes, first of all, it's a skill that we can develop, this idea of self-compassion, because like I said before, something we naturally do. When I work with juniors, we get a chance to get out on the course or on the putting green. I'll stand next to them and have them roll a few putts, short putts, and if they miss one, I'll sort of get in their face a little bit and say, "Whoa, you're a pretty bad putter, huh? I can't believe you missed that one." And they'll sort of look at me funny, and they'll go again, and we'll go through the same drill. And then I'll ask them, "Hey, does this sound familiar? Like, I don't really mean that, but I bet you've heard that before." And they say, "Oh yeah, that's how I talk to myself." Right? So it seems odd when you can play it out that way, that that's how we would speak to ourselves. So the drill almost, or the skill that you can develop, is this idea of, hey, can you substitute maybe the way, or yourself, for say your best friend, someone struggling with the same stuff. And now, how would you support them? What language would you use? And can you start to incorporate that for yourself? And that's how you begin that process of developing some self-compassion.
It's interesting. It's kind of like I'm a big basketball fan, and I think Bill Simmons always talks about guys that are like irrational confidence guys that will come down the floor and just fire a three from anywhere, and they expect it to go in even though they aren't great shooters. And I feel like if you want to be a really great golfer, you almost have to have an irrational sense of self-confidence.
That's a great way to put it, right? Or no fear of what's going to happen if you miss. And I think you can sort of lump that into those guys as well, right? They're not concerned with the result as much, or the fear of missing, because they know that they have such high level of confidence that they're going to be able to support themselves regardless of if they make it or miss it. And if you can put that, right, if you can incorporate that into golf, think about how much better, or how much freer you could swing knowing that you had no fear of where the ball was going to end up.
It's I mean, I think that has to do a lot with confidence and everything, because like you have to have confidence in your short game, because like you know if you miss shots in the wrong spots, and that's where you know getting a ball to a flag that might have a bunker by it is tough. I mean, so what do you see kind of, you know, you've got players across the spectrum. You know, what's the difference between the web guy to the PGA Tour guy to the Latin America or Canadian Tour guy?
Yeah, I think it's such a fine line, right? I mean, as far as physical skill is concerned, I think you could substitute the fields of all those events each week and you'd probably be seeing the same type of scoring. But what separates the guys, I think, that reach the next level or win events, regardless of where it is, are the guys that understand that they accept the fact that they're going to have all these crazy thoughts that you and I have. They're going to be nervous. They're going to be anxious. And instead of fighting themselves, they've come to this understanding that I can still play at a high level regardless of what I'm thinking. And that's what I've found the most with guys that I've worked with and studying golfers, this idea that the guys that play the best when it matters the most are the guys that understand that their thinking is not going to get in the way, because whatever it is they think, it's going to be normal and they're not going to be able to control it. But once they can observe the thoughts they have and know that they're not real, they can move on to whatever it is they're doing without fighting themselves. And in the end, that's how you develop the most freedom.
Yeah, it's so it's interesting, and I'm curious how you think about like how much of a role does like kind of your status as a player play in how you think. So, you know, a multi-time PGA Tour winner, you know, who's got like this sense of security versus a guy that maybe is trying to get, you know, status on the web, like. Does that situation and like kind of the role of where they are in life play like a huge factor in where they the way they think?
Not as much as you would think, and it goes sort of both ways. So I've seen guys who have, won tour events and locked status for a couple of years, and they'll wake up the next morning and they'll have something new that's bothering them, right? Or something new that they're concerned with. Well, I better win again because I don't want to be one of these guys that only wins one. Or, and then you have the guys on the other hand who, when their back's against the wall, I have a guy who plays on the web. He literally had to make the cut to sort of keep going for the year. And not only did he make the cut, he ended up winning. So I think there's guys that respond to that type of pressure differently. But the underlying sort of theme is this idea that regardless of where you are, there's always going to be another challenge. So accepting the fact that where you are is what's most important can help you to proceed without that feeling of pressure. Sometimes not knowing what's coming next can be our greatest ally, because then we can totally immerse ourselves in what we're doing in the moment. So helping guys understand that, like, you just don't know what's going to happen. You may wake up next week and not want to play golf anymore. You just don't know. And that knowing sometimes can be really powerful. And I think that's an idea I try to help guys understand a little bit better, because everyone thinks, well, if I just lock up my card or if I just win a tournament, I'll be happy and I'll have everything figured out. And then they do it and then they're on to something else the next week. So it's constantly changing. So being in that moment is really what's most important.
Yeah, you hear the being in the moment and staying in the moment so much, and you know, and focusing on, you know, the shot at hand rather than the overall, you know, kind of situation. What are, you know, kind of your strategies for keeping golfers in the moment? I think every golfer out there, whether you're, you know, on the verge of breaking 90, or, you know, on the verge of qualifying for your club championship or the US Amateur or, you know, the PGA Tour, is thinking these same things. So like, what are the kind of key strategies you have to keep the players in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, try to keep it very simple when it comes to this idea of being present or immersing yourself in the moment. You can't not think about something. think about that for a second. Like if I told you not to think about white elephant, that's immediately what you would think about. And then you'd spend the next 30 seconds or so sort of fighting with yourself, trying not to. So this idea that the first piece is understanding that, hey, I may be standing on the 18th tee with this chance to break 80 for the first time and start to think about what it's going to feel like. And that's okay. Because what most people think is, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to think that. Right? I'm having all these crazy thoughts about what it's going to feel like after, but I'm not supposed to think that because guys that do break 80 don't think about these things. So understanding that you can't control that piece is the first step. The second piece to being sort of in the moment is not necessarily willing yourself to just be in this moment. It's simply recognizing when you're not. So recognizing when you're standing on that 18th tee, my mind is wandering a bit to, you know, thinking about what it's going to feel like after. Okay, I understand these are normal. I'm going to use this as a sign or a signal to just bring myself back to this, my shot right here, direct experience. So our thinking is away from our direct experience, always. It shoots us up into the future and it takes us back in the past, things that have already, those, again, it's not real. It's not, it takes us away from this direct experience. So recognizing when you're not present is the way you remain present.
Interesting.
It's not this secret formula of saying, I'm going to will myself to be in the present moment. And I'm going to block out all the thoughts that I have about the future or the past. It doesn't work that way. It's simply recognizing when you're not.
Interesting. So, in terms of, you know, how do you feel about, you know, like the whole idea of like relation to par and score? I mean, like I've started to think less and less about it because I've realized it matters so little, because you could be playing great on a day and be two over, you know, and, you know, it's just a tough day. But because there's this idea of score, you know, that you get all stressed out about it, even though you could be,
right.
Everybody else is playing bad, you know, everybody else is shooting above par because it's really tough out there.
Yeah, golf lends itself to that type of thinking because everything has a label attached to it, whether it's a certain shot or it's an up and down or it's a birdie putt or it's how we stand to par. There's so many labels in golf that, you know, you hear this all the time. Well, why don't you just go out there and not think about your score? That's the best thing to do. People talk about that all the time. I don't know anybody who's been able to actually know how they don't stand, meaning they're just not thinking about score. They're so immersed in the moment, they don't know until they add up. I don't know many people that can do that. I haven't heard many stories about people who are successful at that. It may feel like that sometimes, which is great. So recognizing when you start attaching labels and what those labels mean and how they make you feel is the first step in sort of removing the power from them. And when you can become aware of the fact that when you step on a green, I had this guy, client of mine who I still work with, who every time he'd step on a green, regardless of the length of the putt, his first thought was, oh, don't three putt. Well, there's a label right there, right? And that has something to do with relation to par. So now he understands that he still thinks that, but now he understands what it means. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a thought that he has as he steps on the green. He doesn't fight himself. He sort of greets that thought and says, oh, here it is. And now I'm going to go up out and do my business. So trying to get away from that idea of not thinking about how we stand can be really difficult, but understanding the sort of powerlessness of that thought in the moment, it can be really beneficial. And I don't know if that sort of answers your question or if it gets at what you're talking about, but that's sort of my feeling, that you can never stop yourself from doing that. Some people do it more than others, but understanding that there's no power behind those thoughts, really, because we've hit plenty of good shots and had crazy thoughts. And I think you could probably say that, correct?
Yeah. I think, you know, like what I had this moment last year where I was playing a qualifier, and it was at a really tough course. They've hosted a major championship, and it was like a state qualifier. And I'm on the 18th tee, and I'm playing with two guys that are good players, and you know, that qualify for pretty much everything, and I qualify for pretty much everything. And you know, I'm four over par, and I didn't feel like I was playing poorly, you know. And and these guys are just numbers crazed golfers, and they're
right.
on this 18th tee, they convince me that four over par is the score that is going to get out. And sure
Even
enough,
before he teed off.
yeah, before we teed off on the 18th hole. So like, you know,
Right.
they're
Oh,
talking.
sorry. Right. Okay.
So they're
Yeah.
like, oh, four over's got to be the number. There's no way it's going to be five over. And I'm like, so I hit a tee shot and I'm in the right rough and I've got this kind of this, it's like a green with water on both sides. And I like go at it from like a spot where I shouldn't have really played so aggressively. And I hit it in the water, I make a triple bogey, and I'm just like fuming.
Right.
And I go in, I end up making it in on the number. And then
Right.
the scores come in, and the lowest score on the day was 75. And
Yeah.
since that moment, I always know where what I'm score to par wise, but from that moment on, I'm like, I'm no longer going to associate a number to qualifying or a number to
Right.
being good because I knew I was playing pretty well. Like I wasn't playing great. I had left shots out there, but like I knew I wasn't playing poorly. And that if I'm struggling to score well, probably everybody else is.
That's a real, yeah, that makes a ton of sense to me. And it happens time and time again, this idea that we think we need to shoot a certain number, or we play these games with ourselves thinking we need to get to a certain point and that, we'll get in or we'll win the tournament or we'll make the cut or whatever it may be. But in reality, like you said, you never know what score it's going to take. And then I'll ask the question of same thing, say, hey, how many times have you done exactly what you needed to shoot and it was real and you went out and shot it or better? That doesn't happen very often. Otherwise, we'd have no worries at all if we knew what we had to shoot and we went out and shot it, right? That's not how you shoot good scores. You shoot good scores by this understanding that the thoughts you have about what you need to shoot don't mean anything. And you do your best, right, to sort of be, what you say, where your feet are in the moment. Trying to hit the shot that you have right now, not, and this is, we get back to this thing we talked about before this. It's called in Eastern philosophy, the wisdom of uncertainty. If you didn't know what you had to shoot, wouldn't it be a little bit easier? Or if you don't know sometimes, if you're playing a course for the first time and you have some blind tee shots, sometimes it's much easier to have a, to swing free when you don't know what's out there. Some guys prepare so much and then they can't. They're not flexible enough to adjust. The golf is so much variability in golf that they find it very difficult to be flexible when they need to be because they've prepared so much that it robs of our freedom. And that's the same idea. When you know you have to shoot a certain score, it robs us of our freedom. So not knowing, embracing that uncertainty is so powerful, I believe. Yet we're always trying to control everything in golf.
Yeah, I imagine it only gets tougher for the guys that are playing on tour where they have the live scoreboards and leaderboards because like you don't have as much uncertainty, but you see numbers and you put place expectations
Yeah.
on, right?
Yeah, that it is. It is more difficult. Some guys, and people ask me that all the time, hey, should I look at the scoreboard or should I not? Well, I'm not the one to judge. I can't make that decision for you. Do you look at scoreboards and do you find some peace or do you find some freedom from that? Great. If you don't look. But that's, everyone's a little bit different when it comes to that. But if I were to give one sort of piece of advice, in my experience, we play our best or we play most free when we don't know. And sometimes that can be a huge leap for guys who play, especially at the highest level, who are so geared to, and you have to prepare, don't get me wrong, but you also have to remain flexible. And that's something I think that's missing a lot in competitive golf, this flexibility to be able to adjust when things are always going to be different.
It's interesting you say that. So last year, some of my best events, where I played my best, were Mondays after I had a wedding that weekend. So I did
Right.
absolutely nothing, and I showed up to the course a little bit hazy still on Monday morning, and I went out and shot great scores, and sure enough, they were some of my best events versus the ones where. I'm gonna really play well this week in this bigger tournament, and I was super prepared for it.
Right. That's another thing that I talk about a lot, this idea of novel distinction. There's a great psychologist named Ellen Langer who writes about this a lot. She talks about the way we can really sort of embrace the moment or keep ourselves where we need to be is adding some novel distinction to what we're doing. So the perfect example is if you were to brush your teeth with your opposite hand, how focused would you be on that moment?
Probably a lot more.
Or if you were signing your name, yeah, you'd be right there where you needed to be. So golf is the same, can be sometimes the same, is that can you be so, can you add some sort of novel distinction? Now, again, you're not going to want to show up to every tournament, you know, for having that played or not feeling well, but every time when we're not feeling a little bit, you know, not feeling great or the weather's a little bit off, right? Can you use that to really ground you in what you're doing? And that's what I hear that a lot. Guys who play great when they're sick or they have a little injury because they're sort of, they're focused so much on what they're doing in the moment, not worried about what's coming next because they have other things that they're preoccupying their mind. So adding a little novel distinction sometimes can be really helpful. And that's what that is. That's exactly what you're sort of speaking to.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, just what are some ways you can add novel distinction when you don't have it?
Yeah, I mean, there's things you can do in your routine. There's things you can sort of, I have guys sometimes ask themselves the question, hey, how am I feeling right now? Checking in with yourself, right? In the moment, can you be right there? Or finding something on each hole that maybe you've never seen before. Can you pick out something on each hole each time you play that's a little bit different? I mean, there's a bunch of different ways. Right. It's kind of hard to sort of develop enough of that daily, but mm-hmm. it's more the idea. And so people, you know, we talk about pre-shot routines all the time, right? So you get into these routines that we do over and over and over and over again, and they're good for a lot of reasons. But something they're lacking is this idea, again, sometimes can rob us of the freedom that we need in that moment because we can sometimes a pre-shot routine can have us so much on autopilot that we miss a lot of the information that we need in that moment.
Mm-hmm. It's I guess that's it. Yeah, it's something I never even thought of. Yeah, I mean the pre-shot routine just gets hammered down your throat all the time, and I think there's so much good to it, but like there is some thing about being kind of thinking about, you know, where you are.
That's right. And you know, my thinking is that the more aware we are of what we're experiencing in the moment, the better chance we have to sort of remove ourselves from that thinking. And if we're on autopilot so much, we miss that.
Mm-hmm.
So again, some people find that to be troublesome, but I ask them the question, have you ever experienced that? How's it going? Have you ever showed up to a tournament without playing a practice round? How have you done? How's it felt? And a lot of times they'll say, well, it actually felt pretty good. To just sort of be only concerned with what I was doing in that moment, not worried about the tee shot on 17 mm-hmm. or the green on 14 that had all the undulation. Just being right there.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's super interesting. I think a lot of times playing like an event at your home course is a lot tougher than playing an event at a course you know nothing about.
That's a great example. And you've played in enough events and, you know, played in tons of stuff where guys sometimes struggle, right, at their home course because things aren't what they thought they were going to be and they can't adjust.
Interesting. So like, you know, like I think that's a good example for, you know, a lot of the listeners where they play their club championship, you know, year in, year out. What are some strategies for, you know, playing your home course in an event that you've got like a little bit more pressure and succeeding and playing like you would on a normal Saturday?
Yeah. And I think a lot of that pressure comes from, right, like, oh, I've played this course 100 times. It's so easy, but understanding, embracing this idea that every time you tee it up, regardless of where it is or how you feel, it's a brand new experience. So being in that brand new moment allows us to operate much more freely. Mm-hmm. And just the understanding alone that, hey, it's just because it's at my home course, it's not going to be any easier, sometimes is enough. Mm-hmm. Because we go into these tournaments, a lot of people just don't think about it that way. They just think, oh, it's going to be easy. Oh, I have the state and qualifier at my home course this year. Finally, it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
And then things don't go as planned, or, hey, I usually birdie these first three holes, and now I'm two over. Like, what's going on? I can't adjust. So knowing that you need to be flexible, even more so when we're used to doing something over and over again, like playing our home course, can be very valuable.
So I think there's two kind of areas where most golfers struggle is either A, starting rounds, or B, finishing rounds.
Yeah.
And I'm curious kind of what your thoughts are and kind of tips you have for, you know, the guy that A, gets off to a slow start generally, or the player B who has really, you know, who is two under par or whatever it is, but really has trouble bringing it into the house without making a couple of few mistakes that they wouldn't normally make.
Yeah, I think for sure the second, the player B, the guy who has trouble getting it in the house, who's playing well, is, at least from what I see, is much more popular sort of frame of mind, because there's so many things that lead to that. That idea that, hey, how's it like, whoa, I'm about to shoot the course record. How am I going to feel after if I don't? Right? Like, it's not like I go out any day and shoot 80, but now I've put myself in a position to shoot a really good score. And if I don't, it's going to be 100 times worse. So now this fear starts to develop, this idea. And now all of a sudden, we've lived out this entire scenario that hasn't even happened yet, simply because we started sort of paying attention to our thoughts and we were unable to remove ourselves from our thinking. So that gets back to the same idea. Can you get back to this point where you catch yourself almost, or you can create enough space between having these thoughts and then acting in a way that's more skillful, meaning I can use this as a signal to return to what I'm doing. And all that fear, all the reasons why people struggle coming down the stretch is for fear, right? There's no other reason. They're just afraid that, or they're in a place where they've never been. It's a little bit uncomfortable. It's a little bit uncomfortable to be a few under par with a few holes left, knowing you're about to shoot your best score ever, because you've never been there. Mm-hmm. So that discomfort causes us to seek comfort. And in a situation like that, that doesn't exist. So our attempts to seek comfort take our focus away from what we're doing. So that to me is why, you know, and again, you said it happens a lot. And anyone who's played the game has had an experience like that. As far as starting poorly, you know, most of that I think comes from same idea, the nerves of, oh my God, what if I shoot a huge number today? Or, you know, again, we start creating these scenarios that haven't even happened yet. And we start believing them, and then we start reacting to them. And then on the first tee, you're so tense, you can't even pull it back. And it can take a little while. And then you get to a point where this always happens, where you're a few over after a few holes, and then you have this attitude of like, oh, I don't care anymore, right? And then things start to get a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And then this can happen within a round. And then you can get to a point where, oh my God, I'm all the way back to even par. I better not screw this one up. And then you're back to that second scenario, right? So it's constantly going on, regardless of where we stand. You could always think of something crazy that could happen. And we usually do as golfers. And then we start to believe it. And then we start to respond to it. And then we get tense, and then you can't play. And that's sort of the progression that we all fall into when we play golf.
It's just the tension. It's getting rid of tension.
It's all it is, right? So it helps guys try to create some freedom. And that's all it comes down to.
Yeah.
I can't help guys play better, mm-hmm. but understanding how you can be a little bit more free on the golf course is really all you're trying to accomplish.
It's interesting. It's and I think that obviously is the toughest thing. It's all, I mean, no matter what, you get these thoughts in your head, and it's just removing the tension and saying it doesn't really matter if you hit it here or hit it there, because it doesn't, you know?
In the end, it really does. It may matter in the moment, and that's fine too. But like you said, you're going to have all those thoughts no matter what. Nobody's above having those thoughts. I've never talked to a guy who's won a tournament who said they weren't thinking crazy things coming down the stretch. I've never heard it. I've never heard someone say, oh my God, my mind was completely clear. It was so easy. It was like, I don't even know what happened. It doesn't happen.
What are your thoughts on, I heard earlier this year, like just the idea of matching kind of your personality and general demeanor to your golf game and general demeanor on the golf course. Do you think that's important?
100%. And for only one reason, and that when we're happy in our own skin and understand that what we have is enough, we're not trying to beat somebody else. That's when we can be our most free, right? So to tell a guy who's sort of a fiery guy to say, hey, you got to really be calm on the golf course, doesn't work. How does it feel when someone tells you to calm down when you're fired up?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work.
Doesn't.
It just feels worse. Calm down. What's he talking about? So trying to get someone to be somebody different is one, challenging, and two, not necessary. Because again, anytime we have this idea that something would be better or we don't have what we want in that moment, that's when we start to feel that tension again. So yeah, I completely agree with that idea of, hey, you know, that it's simple, right? Be yourself, regardless of what that is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, golf has rules. You can't be a total jerk on a golf course, but to an extent, you know, you just got to be real. John Rahm's a great example, right? He guys doesn't hold back.
Mm-hmm.
He's who he is, and I think there's plenty of guys who would want to have his success. You know, but he tried to bottle that up, his head's going to explode.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, like, it, you know, versus holding it up or getting it out, because, like, you know, people get so, you know, turned off by people that, you know, let out their anger, but, like, in the same time, like, you have to get it out or else it's just going to steam and it's going to carry over into the next shot and next hole.
There's an old saying, what we resist persists. And it, for anger and frustration, it couldn't be more true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but again, I think also, though, the anger doesn't serve us very well in the long term. So sometimes we have to learn that lesson the hard way. So sometimes guys will get to the point where I don't want to be angry anymore because the game, I don't feel good. So you can learn that on your own, but having someone tell you to not be angry never works.
So what would you say to a player that, you know, like, and not, you know, like that runs similar to John Rahm where it gets hot, like what would you be your strategies and, like, you know, the ways to get your anger out with that aren't, like, publicly, you know, you give you a bad perception.
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, and I think as golfers, especially at that highest level, we do know that, right? Like, he knows deep down that this behavior, one, is probably serving him very well, and two, at some point, could get him in trouble, right? Whether it's financially or something, right? So, I mean, you just can't do that. So letting guys know that there are other ways to respond is number one. There are other ways to respond to situations other than get angry or upset, and explain to them what those reactions mean. And again, it's a process, but again, sometimes guys just take some time to, they need to learn that on their own. But to let them know that there are other ways to respond that will provide you an opportunity to sort of operate from a much, you know, more free feeling, because anger sort of binds us up also a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And at the guys, especially at the highest level, they're concerned with playing good golf. Well, you could play better responding in different ways, but it's not something you just snap your finger and, like I said, tell a guy to stop being angry. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. It's a process, like anything,
Yeah, and it's not changing the way you think as much as changing the way you think about how you think, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's relating to your thoughts in a different way, because we can't really change how we think, but we can change our understanding of what our thoughts mean, and that's where the sort of shift comes from.
So, you know, I think, like, where the biggest fear We've talked a lot about like the fear of failing and, the fear of missing and, where I think it comes out the most is on the putting green. And these truly great putters, they seem to pour everything in, and people that are, good putters or average putters or below average putters always wonder, like, how does this guy make so many putts and what is he thinking when he's putting? Do you have something that you like to, kind of preach of, like, getting, thoughts out of your head and just thinking about, making the putt while you putt? Or like, how, what's your kind of philosophy on putting?
Yeah, no, I definitely steer away from the idea that you need to change what you think, because again, it will get back to that idea of sort of creating tension. But changing your understanding about what those thoughts mean, it can be a game changer for a lot of guys to know that you can stand over a putt and not feel 100% about making it and still make it, because that happens all the time. Now, the problem with putting is it's black or white. It either goes in or it doesn't, and there's an immediate sort of judgment. If you're on the tee and you hit one in the rough, you can still make an eagle or a birdie. But on the green, you get the immediate result right away. So there's such an emphasis on making or missing that it's very difficult to remove that, right? No matter who you can't get away from it. So it either goes in or it doesn't. So I think expectation on the green is really, first place to start with that. You look at the top tour pros and how many putts they make inside 10 feet. I think a lot of people are surprised at how many they actually miss. So expectation is the first piece. But the greatest example there is, if someone has the yips, so they struggle with the short ones, right? Either those guys don't struggle with 30 footers or 40 footers. Their stroke's pretty smooth. It's only because this idea that, whoa, if I miss the short putt, how am I going to look, or how is it going to feel? So it's starting to get to that, like, how does this make me feel when I miss it? And then starting to work backwards from that, you can start, once you start unraveling that fear, now it's a little bit easier to make that stroke. Now, again, it doesn't guarantee you're going to make a putt, but all you can do is make a good stroke. It's all you can do.
Yeah, it's true. So it's trying to get away from, it's just understanding you're gonna miss putts, and it happens. But like the I mean, and that's like part of, like, they always say that Tommy Roy and, like, I forgot the other producer for CBS is like the most powerful man in golf, because they determine what the public perception is.
Yeah, that's a great point. I say this, guys, all the time. When you're watching golf on TV, what do you see?
You see the leaders. You see people making
The
putts
guys that
because
are
that's
playing
the
great.
yeah. And you see them making
I have
putts.
a joke with my dad. My dad, he's a big golf fan, and we always talk, and he'll talk on Monday, and he always says, "Man, that guy who won, he played great." Yeah, no shit, he won. But that's all we see. So people, the average fan, doesn't walk practice rounds with these guys, doesn't see the guys that are struggling to make the cut, doesn't see the guys missing three or four footers. So we just assume that, hey, this is what golf is. It's making every putt, it's hitting every fairway, and it's winning tournaments.
I mean, that's why I always tell people, like, the best way to watch a golf tournament is to find like a group of good players, but don't go watch the stars. Find like the guys that are, you're good, maybe above average, middle of the road player on the PGA Tour, and walk with them for 18 holes, because then you see
Yeah.
the ebbs and flows of the round, where I'm curious what you think about this, but like, I think that there's always, no matter what, like 3 or a 4 hole stretch where you lose, it's very rare for you to hit the ball great for 18 straight holes, and so much of
Right.
it is dictated on, like, when you hit that patch where you struggle is how you get out of that patch.
You couldn't be more right about that. And that's the best way to watch is see when a guy faces some adversity or when he's a little uncomfortable, what he does, right? Because these guys make their money not when they're playing great, but when they're playing poorly, and how they adjust in those situations. Because the game, like you said, is too hard to play great for 18 holes or for a few weeks in a row. It's just too hard. So you really earn your money, right, when things aren't going so well. Because you sort of find ways to put up a decent number when you're not playing well, because it's too hard to play well all the time. So yeah, and I agree with that. Watching a group, if you have that opportunity, is can be really beneficial, regardless of who it is, because you really see everything. As far as this, you're going to struggle at some point during the round, or some holes, everything's just going to look easier. Putts are going to drop, or sometimes they're going to miss a few putts, and what are they going to do next? And that can be a really interesting perspective.
Yeah, I think that's, it's like, you know, people get caught up in, you know, and it does require a lot more work. I mean, you're going to walk 18 holes, you're going to,
sure,
you know.
No,
like,
for sure. Not everyone has that opportunity.
But at the same time, you lose, you know, you when you're just sitting on a hole or you're trying to watch the, you know, the star players that featured pairing, like, you lose so much perspective because you're fighting the crowds and you're not going to see every shot. You know, you know, I think it's a really unique, because all these guys are so good and they all have all the skills, and the margins are so razor thin that, you know, it's interesting at the players where, you know, I watched Blaine Barber play a lot of golf, and Blaine finished like, you know, like I think he finished top 20 that event. And in the first two rounds, he had like two moments where he made like, you know, a double or a triple, and it wasn't like he hit a bad shot. But then, you know, I watched Siwoo Kim, pretty much his entire back nine of the final round, and you see him in similar situations, and that's where he won, because he got up and down and was stress-free, you know, putting
that's
it.
Right.
You know, like, he was hitting chips to 2 feet where Blaine Barber, you know, makes a double. And that, that those micro moments was the difference between Blaine Barber winning and finishing, you know, T20th, and Siwoo winning and finishing, you know, 10th.
You couldn't be more right. The difference is so small. And again, that's what it comes down to. It's, you know, when you face some adversity, what are you going to do with it? Because you're going to. And if you run from it and you try to seek comfort in those situations, you're going to struggle.
So with it, you know, is it just, you know, is it really commitment? Is it saying I'm just going to hit this shot?
The idea of committing to each other, you hear that a lot, right? Like this idea, like you got to commit 100% to each shot. Well, what does that mean? You know, that's what I ask guys all the time. What does it mean to you to commit? Because a lot of guys don't know what it means to be committed. Does that mean I tell myself I'm committed? Does that mean I'm not thinking about anything else? Does that mean, you know, there's a lot, and everyone's got a little sort of different idea, but once you come up with your own definition of commitment, now you've reached sort of this new level of commitment.
Yeah.
Because I think it means something different to everyone. So defining that first is really important. And I think, you know, you'd be surprised. I'm surprised always when I ask guys what that means, that a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I just want to hit a good shot. Well, of course, you want to hit a good shot in every hole or every shot. So defining that for people is really important. That's the first step. And that's a tool that people, you know, who are listening can take with them. Take a minute and define what commitment means to you and write it down and bring it with you. And I think you'd be surprised how different it is than what you think it is. So, but then you have the example of guys who, you know, you can still hit good shots and not be committed. I mean, it's ideal, right? But there's going to be shots where you're standing over them and you're just not going to feel good. So understanding that you can still hit good shots in those moments can also be really powerful. Because if we're trying to get committed in a situation where we're just not, it's not going to happen, then that tension comes, right, that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I'm sort of obsessed with this idea of creating freedom. And I believe it comes from this happiness with where we are in the moment, this contentment. And it's not being a lazy sort of just settling. It's a complete acceptance of what we have in that moment and knowing that that's enough. And that's going to give me the best shot chance to be committed to hitting a shot.
Mm-hmm. It's that you're being content. How much do you think playing partners and caddies play, like, you know, like, especially at a higher level on tour, like, Is that because of that comfort you just talked about? Is it, you know, is there a lot of effect that having a good pairing and, you know, obviously you have to have a good caddy relationship.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate enough to get to know a lot of the caddies quite well, and such good guys. And people forget that some, you know, if you know your guy doesn't make the cut, makes the money, you're not going to be making as much money either. So there's this added sort of built-in pressure sometimes on players. Hey, I want to play well because I want my guy to feel good about me. Like, we're going to make some money too. Like, I mean, it
Yeah.
sounds silly, but there's this added sort of layer to that relationship. So the best caddies are the guys that sort of instill this sort of comfort, really, right? Regardless of the situation, everything's, you know, this is going to be good. And those are the best, the guys that have that figured. And again, the guys that get to know their players, well, know what, you know, makes them tick almost. You know when to say something and when not to. Because everyone's different as far as players are concerned, in terms of what they need. Some guys need a little extra hand holding, some guys don't want to hear a word when they're playing. So those relationships can be huge. And again, like I said, I've been fortunate enough to sort of see some of those relationships develop and how powerful they can be.
I think that's you see it. You have guy. You see it in am golf even, like where you have buddies caddy. Like my favorite caddy for myself is like I have a cousin who's a high school baseball coach, and he used to be a really he was a minor league pitcher, and he just understands like what to say, and like he's good at motivating and you know especially like when I you know I have a tendency to get down on my luck and down in the dumps and. And you know he has a good way of like getting me out of being a moper, you know. And but I think you know he has that built-in like that's what he does, you know, 9 months of the year with high school kids, you know. So I think that helps a ton. And it's not necessarily, you know, the best caddy isn't necessarily the best player you know or the guy that you play the most golf with because he's probably the guy that knows how to razz you and get under your skin a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's exactly right. So you know, right? You know how important those relationships can be.
It's interesting. So, we do like this little overrated, underrated segment, and I want to get into that here. And the first one I'm curious about, and you know, usually these are like, you know, answers that are like, you know, overrated, underrated, but you know, feel free to expound because I think that it'd be beneficial. You know, preparing differently for different events. Like, you know, this is a big event, so I'm gonna prepare differently. What are your thoughts on preparing for like major championships?
Overrated. Because as great as it would be to win those events, everyone that tees it up in a normal event wants to win just as bad. So why would you prepare any different? I think preparing for what the event, may feel like is a little bit different. Like it's a different animal at the majors. There's a lot more going on, and preparing yourself for that may be, a little bit different. But as far as your attempt to play your best and put yourself in the best position, you're trying to do that every time.
Yeah, I think that I do it. I'm, you know, I try and prepare more for different events, but you know, it's probably not smart to do. It's like, you know.
Well, but sometimes, like for folks like us, we just, we only have a few big events, and that's it. And or we have time constraints as far as what we can do. But you want to do, like this we say to guys all the time, the objective of golf is the same, regardless of if you're playing in a mixed 9-hole member guest or if you're playing in the U.S. Open. It's always to make the lowest score possible in every hole. It doesn't change. So why would you change your preparation to try to achieve that goal, regardless of the outside, right? The labels that we attach to tournaments or what they mean, when the objective is always the same.
Yeah. It's, I, it makes sense. It's, It's just making it simpler, really.
In a way, yeah. I mean, because it is simple. We complicate things by attaching all these labels to it, but the objective is always the same. And I sometimes a lot of my work with people is just reminding them of that in so many, in different ways. But that idea that it's always the same, and there's very few moments in your career where making a bogey is going to be okay. Right? I mean, you could probably count them on one hand where, like, you have a 10-shot lead or something, and making a bogey would be okay. It's usually 99% of the time, it's putting yourself in a position to make the lowest possible score. And it doesn't change from that ever.
Swing thoughts, overrated, underrated.
I don't know if I can give you an answer. Because again, this comes back to this idea that you can tell yourself not to have swing thoughts and you still might have them, or you may tell yourself to have swing thoughts and forget them. You can still play at a high level regardless of what it is you're thinking. So I guess in that respect, I would say overrated, meaning you either have them or you don't. It's not a whole lot you can do about it. You can write something down and read it before every shot. If that helps you find some comfort, great. But you can also hit the ball just as well without it. But I think people fall into this trap a lot of times and say, oh man, I've heard I'm only supposed to have two or three swing thoughts. Well, try and limit yourself to have two or three thoughts before each shot and see how that goes. Our minds are constantly running, constantly working. So there's some tension right there, limiting yourself to thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it probably has to do a lot with your personality too.
Yeah, some guys, find it. I like to use the term, and I work with a lot of coaches, and we try to develop swing feels instead of thoughts. So, like, coach will be working with a player, and they're working on a certain sort of move or position, and they'll say, okay, put a word to that. Whatever, it could be anything. It could be pizza, it could be screwdriver, it could be anything. And that's your feel, that's your swing feel, right? So when you say that to yourself, that you know what that feels like, and that's where you're trying to get. That makes that that's a, that can be a little bit more tangible and a little bit more easy to sort of work with.
I think that's it's that it makes a lot of sense. It's so next one is equipment.
That's it?
Yeah, like equipment, like the idea of
Just
like
equipment.
yeah. Hey, all right, so like
I
yeah, equipment. We're going very broad here.
may be a little hypocritical because in addition to what I do in helping folks try to simplify things, I'm a huge equipment sort of geek. And I'm a big fan of Golf WRX and I'm on there all the time. I buy stuff on eBay all the time and I'm always selling stuff. And so I try to separate the two. I know I would probably be a better golfer if I didn't change my putter every 2 weeks. But I enjoy that piece of the game. Like to me, that's part of the enjoyment I get from golf is the equipment. And I love reading about it and I love learning about it. When it comes to working with my players, I think it's, when it comes to the putter at least, that sometimes a brand new look can shake things up a little bit. But in the end, I think getting too far away from what got you to a certain point, trying to find the quick fix with equipment can be, you start yourself down a little slippery slope there. But I think the putter more than anything. I think irons and drivers, they're all so good now. And when we're talking about guys at the highest level, the equipment companies can basically make them anything they want. So I don't necessarily think that that's an issue as much, but I do believe that there's something to the putter, and I think that's more of a personal sort of connection.
Yeah, I kind of meant the putter. I probably should have narrowed that down. That's what I was thinking of. Curious, you said something that made me think of a question. I would curious your perspective of is like, these guys that get to tour and then there's a lot of cases of like they get to tour based off their game, and then they try and add a wrinkle to their game that they feel they're lacking in, like whether it be distance or the ability to hit a ball the cer a certain you know certain shape. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are pretty clear cut on that. And there's an example in that every time you hear of a guy who sort of maybe disappeared for a couple of years and gets back to where they were or starts finding success again, they usually say the same thing. I just try to simplify things, or I try to get back to what I used to do. Right? Does that resonate a little bit? Like
Oh,
you've heard
yeah.
those stories before, correct? I think we grew up, all of us, a lot of us in the Tiger era, where he was winning tournaments and constantly tinkering with his swing to get better. And I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to get better, but I do believe when we play our best, again, it comes back to this idea that we're happy with what we have and we sort of wear it out, meaning we know exactly what we're doing. It's comfortable to us. It's not a big change. So I do believe that for that reason alone, that this idea of really trying to simplify things physically, or at least using them as a guide, is what's most important. It's always important. You know, always guys are always wanting to get better. And that's, I get that. That's fine. It motivates people. But getting too far away from what got you to where you are can be tough.
Yeah, it's I think that's you know you got to play your game and own your
Yeah,
game.
but you know, we're pulled in so many different ways. I mean, you see it even on tour. Guys walk down the range and they're seeing guys do different drills and, you know, hitting different clubs, and they're asking about it, and they're constantly, you know, tinkering with things to try and improve. And it's, there's such an allure. There's such a, you know, it's hard to get away from, and it's always basic. Equipment companies are coming out with new stuff every couple of months, and it's new and it's shiny. You can hit 10 yards farther. You know, why not? Maybe that's the secret. So fighting that can be really difficult for guys, but I do believe that, like you said, yeah, owning what you do is really important.
So you get to talk to all these world-class golfers, and you know, you probably learn a lot yourself, but like, who's the one guy, whether he's, you know, playing actively now or whether he's, you know, he's kind of past his playing days, who's the guy that you'd like to have like a weekly or monthly conversation about golf with that you don't get
Ooh.
To? This is the last
yeah,
question.
I mean, Tiger Woods would be the unanimous, or would be the easy answer for a guy who found so much success under such a microscope. That would be, to me, would be the ultimate to get a peek into that sort of world. But current now, guys that are playing well, like I really am a fan of how DJ plays. People say he does. He looks like he doesn't care, and so, but he absolutely does.
Yeah.
But he's been able to overcome such adversity. I mean, all the things that have happened to him in majors where he's played poorly, from it also with, you know, social issues, everything that's sort of, you know, gone against him. He's found a way to succeed. And that to me is really impressive, and that's another guy that now that I think what he's done is quite admirable, and a lot of people should look to that guy as a model in terms of how you face adversity and how you overcome it.
Yeah, I feel like everybody, like the easy storyline is like, oh, DJ doesn't really work that hard. It's like, you know, like you don't get to world number one if you don't work hard, you know.
Right, and hard work is sort of, there's a big misconception. Hard work doesn't necessarily mean going to the range for 8 hours and beating balls. Hard work is finding what works for you, right?
Yep.
Whether that's hitting balls for 10 minutes or it's hitting for eight, whatever. But he's found that, and he does care. I guarantee you, I know for a fact, right? And he works at it, whatever that means to him.
Yeah, he's found his peace, and I think like that his mentality on the golf course, like I mean, I always look at that and be like, God, like it just doesn't look like he feels so at peace with what he's doing, you know.
He does, and it's almost more fun, selfishly, not for him, to see him when he's struggling, because not much changes. And he's really good. His demeanor is fantastic. And obviously you don't know what's going on inside his head, but he just projects this sense of freedom that to me is like, that's gold.
Yeah. He's in very interesting study, and watching him hit a golf ball is pretty unbelievable also.
Yeah. He's also a physical freak. I mean, he's unbelievable what he can do. And I mean, freak in the nicest sense of the word. It's fun. Like you said, it's fascinating to watch.
Mm-hmm. So, hey, we appreciate you coming on. It was a fun talk. We'll have to do it again. Everybody can find Greg. You're on Twitter. It's at GC3Greg. Any other way people can get reached out to you?
Yeah, I have a website with my contact information, at least not a whole lot of information just now, mindfulmindset.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also on Instagram and trying to get some more content up there. I'm sort of behind the times when it comes to social media, but same address on Instagram, GC3Greg.
Yeah, I don't know what your Instagram strategy should be, but I'll think about it.
A lot of stuff on there is pictures of my kids and a couple of golf stuff. But so I gotta get that ramped up a little bit.
Maybe quotes. You know, quotes could be cool.
Yeah, that's actually not a bad idea.
Yeah,
I may look into that.
Interesting little thoughts that people could take. You know. So.
Yeah. No, I like that.
But, we appreciate you coming on and look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed talking to you, and best of luck with the podcast, and would love to come back.